It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, we are putting your summer entertaining worries to rest. Our expert is none other than Gourmet Magazine editor Ruth Reichel. Now, she says great and sane entertaining is all about two things. You get them right, and everything else falls into place. And she's left us a menu to boot. Jane and Michael Stern have uncovered a barbecue chicken like no other in Candor, New York. We have a modern take on cheese suppers from Steve Jenkins. Chef Jerry Traunfeld has us making our own capers. And just in time for the nation's birthday, British novelist Jim Crace tells us of the sweet purge of spitting out your birthday. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
We both liked corn dogs at the start. We once shared pastries from the cart. I know that low cholesterol is good for my heart, but these fights over what to eat are tearing us apart. When we were young, we shared a common tongue. We ate and ate and ate and ate and never gained a bit of weight. But the years have changed your attitudes about what is fit to eat. You've become a lacto-vegetarian and I'm still into red meat. We both like corn dogs at the start. We once shared pastries from the cart. I know that low cholesterol is good for my heart, but these fights over what to eat are tearing us apart. Death of me. Caffeine, well, it's poison, and it's in coffee and in tea. But the birdseed that you'd have me eat would make breakfast a bore. And please don't tape those calorie charts on every cupboard door. We once ate ice cream and French fries. Now you see every bit of fat goes straight to your thighs. If you would just enjoy your food, I'd love you at any size. Come share some cake with me, you're still skinny in my eyes. Don't you know I'd rather have a pound or two of prime red meat? Listen, Mr. Manager, I'd like to rent my food instead.
You rent to me, I'll bring it back. You rent it out to someone else. You'll make more money than you ever did before.
The roast I got is A-OK, its former owner had no teeth.
teeth.
You rent me, I'll bring it back. You rent it out to someone else who'll make more money than you ever did before.
Food rent.
Food rent.
Food to borrow.
Food to borrow.
Deposit reward.
I'll return it back to
yum
yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum
yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum
yum yum yum yum yum yum
yum
yum yum yum yum yum
yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum
yum yum yum yum yum yum yum yum
yum
yum yum yum yum yum yum
yum yum
yum yum
yum
Food to borrow.
Deposit reward. I'll return it by tomorrow.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's menu salvation. We solve your entertaining dilemmas. Our expert is Gourmet Magazine editor Ruth Reichel. She says doable entertaining is all about bookends, beginnings, and endings. Then it's a modern take on the cheese supper from Steve Jenkins. Imagine no cooking, and the accompaniments are dynamite. Chef and herb expert Jerry Traunfeld tells us how to make our own capers from the gorgeous nasturtium. British storyteller Jim Crace documents a birthday tradition like no other. Now, I think of it as spiritual spitting. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with the ever curious, ever hungry Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, what's up?
Lynn, we are beside ourselves with happiness because we found a new regional specialty. You know, after 25 years of being on the road, we kind of thought we had seen everything. Well, we were up in around Ithaca, New York, and we found something called Cornell chicken. We have never heard of this before, but everywhere in this area that you go, especially in the summer, you will get Cornell chicken.
Now, what is Cornell chicken?
Cornell chicken, so named because it was actually invented by a Cornell professor about 50 years ago, is barbecue chicken that is marinated. And what distinguishes it is a kind of egg-rich vinaigrette marinade that gives it a tangy and yet very luscious taste. As the chicken cooks over hardwood coals, it is sopped with this marinade constantly. And it just absorbs the flavor of the marinade down to the bone. It's absolutely delicious.
Wait. You have egg in a marinade? I've never heard of egg in a marinade.
Well, that's because you have never encountered a chicken with a college education, and that's the way they do it at Cornell. Some marinades have the egg, some do not, but it's kind of a white vinegary marinade. And especially in the summer, there are all these little ad hoc cafes and roadside places that have signs in front of them saying we specialize in Cornell chicken. But our absolutely favorite Cornell chicken is at a place that's actually in Candor, New York, which is about 5 miles from Ithaca, and it's called Jim's Barbecue.
It's much more than 5 miles from Ithaca. It's in the orbit of Ithaca, and it serves classic Cornell chicken, which means that not only is it cooked in the classic way, it's served in the classic manner, which is picnic style, with potato salad, macaroni salad, and a couple of other salads. You sit outdoors in Jim Kurtz's backyard, basically, at a picnic table he's set up. There's room for maybe 30 people, and it feels much more like a picnic than it does a restaurant. He's been doing it this way for 10 years. He started on a Mother's Day cooking for friends. The friends liked it so much they told other people, and it became Jim's Barbecue on Foundry Street in a neighborhood in Candor, New York.
It's like going to somebody's backyard barbecue, but you don't know who they are, but you're still a welcome guest anyway. It's under a tent. and he has country western music playing on his radio. Really nice, affable guy. And if you get there early before the chicken is ready, as we did, of course, because for us dinner starts at 3 p.m, you can just sit there and, you know, kibitz around with him and watch him cook his marinated chicken.
And discuss wood with him. This guy is really into wood and charcoal and how to make it right. And he said the secret is not only in the marinade, for which everybody up there knows the recipe, it's in burning down that hardwood. So it burns way down and becomes charcoal. Then you put the chicken on. He said you put the chicken on too early, you're going to get that that peculiar charcoal-y taste.
The best time to go to Jim's Barbecue is on the weekend, because then you get salt-roasted potatoes served with your Cornell chicken. Oh. And that is really a wonderful combination. This is not, you know, the kind of red sauce Memphis barbecue that, you know, with pork that we all think of as classic barbecue. This is a very distinct regional twist on barbecue. And even though Michael is telling me it's more than 5 miles away, to me, philosophically, it is right next to Ithaca, since it is Cornell chicken.
But it is in the greater orbit of that part of the southern tier of New York State where marinating things is really the big deal. You know, I think we've talked with you before, Lynn, about marinated Speedies in Binghamton. Marinating meat and then cooking it over coals is a real thing in this part of the world.
Well, once again, you have gone into the archaeological aspect of regional cuisine.
Isn't that exciting to find a new thing? It's so exciting to find a new regional specialty.
I love the idea of eating on the picnic table in the backyard. Hey, thanks,
yeah,
guys.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern's newest book in their road food series is Louie's Backyard Cookbook. Jane's new book is Ambulance Girl. Now, the Sterns come by every week with a report, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, there's another thing, by the way, to check on the website. It's our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we send you a new recipe for a quick weeknight supper. There are technique tips and shopping information, and best of all, it is free. All you have to do is sign up, splendidtable.org. As you probably know by now, Cheese Authority Steve Jenkins has never been one to hold back an opinion. But I figure after 25 years of hunting down artisan cheeses on both sides of the Atlantic and getting his information firsthand, he's entitled. Steve knows his stuff. Hey, Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be here with you.
So what have you been musing lately?
Musing or using, Lynn?
Either one. I'll take either one, Steve.
Well, I don't know. In my old age, I'm getting cranky about restaurants. Enough already. Going out and spending all that money at restaurant for a meal that you probably won't even remember the next day. My wife and I find it to be so much more rewarding to have people over to the house and entertain them there. And it's my thought that you don't always have to do a dinner for your best friends. Why not instead do a great cheese evening? Do three great composed cheese plates. What a bunch of fun, not to mention the fact that the accompaniments that I'm going to suggest that you serve with these cheese plates are as every bit as exciting as the cheeses themselves.
Okay, then we need specifics.
Good Lord, I got them. I do lectures all the time on cheese, and this is really pretty much the way I'll do a tasting lecture, which is three specific plates that incorporate three specific cheeses each, and one or two accompaniments along with them. And then, of course, great bread and specific beverages to go with each plate. I find that I like lately to separate the milks. I like to do a goat cheese plate first, and then a sheep's cheese plate second, and then the cow's milk plate third. And no particular reason. I just find that the accompaniments that I agonize over seem to go so much better with specific animals' cheeses. Goat cheeses, I like to serve savory stuff. Sheep cheeses, I like to sort of mix. I serve one savory and one sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And with the cow's milk plate, I like to serve sweet stuff. So I turn a complete blind eye, Lynn, to regionality, and I choose cheeses that range all over the map. It's not going to be a French plate. It's not going to be a Spanish plate. It's not going to be an Italian plate. I'm going to mix up different countries' regions on each plate. So on the first plate, if I chose to do all three goat's milk cheeses, I would have probably one great French chef, of which there are so many. I'm looking at a menu I did recently where I had a Chevrotin de Bauges, which is a great Savoie goat cheese, and I served with it the great Humboldt Fog from California,
mm-hmm.
And then a Piemontese goat's milk cheese that's called Tuma della Paja. All three very different textures and very different intensities of flavor, and they go so beautifully with the accompaniment, which in this case I served some roasted tomatoes and a mixture of olives that I had washed and dressed with a little bit of an herb and a hot chili and drizzled with olive oil, and then great bread and a specific wine or beverage or beer to go with each plate. With this goat cheese plate, I'd pick some fruity, sort of light red wine like a Pinot Noir.
Uh-huh.
Could come from Oregon, could come from Washington, could come from any place.
Okay, what about the sheep cheese plate?
Sheep cheese plate, same thing. It'd be wide-ranging. It wouldn't necessarily be from one country. I'd pick, for instance, a Corsican sheep's cheese like Brenda Moore or U Pecorino, which are very peasanty, very sort of herby-tasting sheep's cheeses that are sort of a mid-texture, neither custardy nor flinty dry. Another sheep's cheese that I would serve would be the Serpa from Portugal, which is very custardy and made from raw sheep's milk from the Alentejo part of very central Portugal, gorgeous area where the thistles that grow everywhere, these gorgeous thistles that blanket this part of Portugal, they use that thistle to curdle the milk, which is a beautiful thing. And for the third sheep's cheese, it'd probably be a Basque sheep's cheese that's got that wonderful olivey texture. It's very supple yet firm. And with that, I would probably serve some sort of bitter Catalan honey.
Mm.
And I might get a little jar of a porcini and white truffle paste that I would smudge onto the plate that would... Oh, boy, would that be good to smear onto those shards of bread and serve with that sheep's cheese. That'd just be sensational. Okay. And I'd probably serve some pretty rough red wine, either a Rhone or a Syrah, Shiraz, something like that.
Okay, we'll move into the cows now.
That's what's so fun about this 1-2-3 shot, because you just get three fabulous opportunities to blow everybody's mind. And the third plate, you can certainly do it with the cow's milk cheeses. I'd serve an Epoisse from Burgundy, which is the most staggeringly delicious cheese in the entire universe. I'd serve a Blue at this juncture because I want really, really assertive intensities of flavor to match that Epoisse. And for the third cow's milk cheese, my goodness, what would I do? What would I do? Oh, I'd have to go to England. I'd have to serve like the Lincolnshire Poacher, which is a great, great Somerset cheddar. And all of those would be brilliant to serve with some Persian melon or some Gallia melon or even cantaloupe, along with some not necessarily fresh fruit, say some dried figs and some dried apricots or maybe a handful of cherries. Or take some hazelnuts and some almonds and toast them on a tray so that you're serving them very, very warm with these three cow cheeses and the melon. That would be sublime. And if you know which each one of these cheeses is and where they come from, the conversation is just rampant because very likely somebody at the table has been to that particular region or knows something about it. So it's just so much fun, and it's the conversation is just a lot more effervescent than if you're just serving, you know, a bloody entree and an appetizer and a dessert. It's just more fun to do a cheese plate night.
Well, Steve, we're on to it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I still think he should have been a chef. Well, Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now, he can be found behind the cheese counter at Fairway Markets in New York City, but Steve's cheese picks, well, they're on our website, splendidtable.org.
Coming up, the summer menu from Gourmet Magazine's Ruth Reichel, homemade capers, spiritual spinning for our nation's birthday, and open lines for your calls. You can call us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. SuperTarget believes in putting the fun back into food. It's a grocery store right inside Target. To find a store near you, you can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Whole world is ripe, gorgeous produce is throwing itself in your shopping cart. Everything is calling out for a party. Except it's hot, you're working a horrendous schedule, the kids are home all the time, and the last time you threw a party, you spent the night in the kitchen. Well, we're coming to the rescue with an expert on entertaining. Our guest is Ruth Reichel. She is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, but maybe more important, Ruth has a horrendous schedule, and she cooks all the time. Ruth, welcome.
Great to be here.
So, Ruth, when you lay out a menu for entertaining, now I realize you have the entire culinary world at your feet, but I know you entertain a lot. When you lay out a menu, how do you figure it so it's easy?
Well, the first thing that I do is make sure that I have a spectacular dessert, and I make it early in the day. So no matter what else happens, I know that people are going to go out the door with something really wonderful in their mouths. And that's what they're going to remember from the party. And I get it done early. So if I have a disaster, I can do it again.
This makes sense.
I want it done before noon, the day of the party. And the other thing that I want is something wonderful to start. So people walk in the door and they have something great and they're leaving with something great. What happens in between, you know, if you have a mistake, and God knows everybody has disasters in the kitchen, you know, it's not the end of the world and you can just sort of skate through the rest of it. Now, my theory is basically you spend your major efforts on this first thing, and my idea is that the first thing should be something that you walk around with. I don't like seated first courses because it means that while your guests are eating that first course, you've got to be in the kitchen getting the main course ready. I mean, even if it's something that's very simple that you've stuck in the oven, you got to slice it. You got to put it in the pan. There's always some last minute thing. So I want my guests standing around with me in the kitchen or, you know, in the living room, munching on something. But when we sit down, I don't want to have to get up again.
How do you feel about having people around you when you're cooking? Because I think a lot of people get really nervous about that.
Well, it is distracting. On the other hand, by the time I'm that far into the party, I sort of like the help. I think it, one of the great things that happened to me early on in my entertaining life is that, organized as I was, I didn't get done in time. And people walked in and they had to help me, and I realized they liked it. It made everybody feel a part of it. It's a little intimidating if your hostess is so perfect. So I like the idea of having people help. And, I, you know, you can just say, you know, could you saute those onions for me? I'm very big on having the participation. Now, I know that everybody isn't, and you sort of have to figure out what works for you.
I know you produce a magazine, but I want you to put your editor's hat aside for a minute. When you see a magazine menu, how do you analyze it to see if it's really going to work?
Well, one of the, certainly this time of year, one of the things that I do is look at how much time you're actually going to be in the kitchen. Figure out, you know, it's nice to have a cold meal, but it's not nice if it means that you're spending 8 hours in the kitchen boiling things and roasting things for hours and hours. I also think a lot about, I look at the ingredients and think, you know, how realistic is this? You know, can I get these ingredients? Another thing that I think about a lot is how expensive is it? I mean, money does come into it. And I don't want a meal that's going to ask for a lot of expensive things in every part of the menu. So I go through the ingredients and think, okay, if I'm going to have a fillet of beef, which is great, it's quick and very easy, I don't want a lot of other big expenses in that menu.
Yeah, and especially this time of year where there's so much you can do with inexpensive ingredients like vegetables and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Well, you've got a couple of menus in Gourmet that I'd like you to walk us through to give us some specific ideas for things we can do.
Okay, well, we have this sort of lazy summer porch menu, and it's, to me, an almost perfect menu. It starts with a shrimp scallop and lobster ceviche that you mix with lime and mint chilies, and then there's a real surprise in it, which is watermelon. So it's really crisp and refreshing. You do it ahead of time, and you serve it in lettuce leaves. So it's, again, it's walking around food. Your guests sort of scoop it into these lettuce leaves and eat it with their fingers. And then there's a fabulous fresh fig tart with a rosemary cornmeal crust. I love this because it's a surprise at the end of the meal. It's beautiful. It's very simple to do, but it's a real surprise.
And those are the bookends you talked about.
And those are the bookends.
The beginnings and the endings.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the middle, it's very simple. It's a grilled steak, and the little, you know, imaginative part of this, it's got a really wonderful red chili sauce. Again, you make it ahead. And it's got pickled red onions that you put on top of it. You can make those a week ahead. And then surrounding that is a really wonderful and very beautiful heirloom tomato salad that you drizzle with bacon and blue cheese. And you stack it up, and it's just gorgeous. And then some corn and green beans in a lime shallot butter that you just sauté. So it's a very approachable menu. With a surprise on both ends.
So what we're going to remember now is bookends. Great beginning, great ending, and whatever happens in the middle, it's all going to be okay.
Exactly.
Ruth, thank you.
Thank you. Happy entertaining.
Ruth Reichel is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Find that lazy front porch menu with the watermelon ceviche. And by the way, the fish is cooked, so don't panic. Heirloom tomatoes with blue cheese, basil, and bacon, and the fresh fig tart on the website, splendidtable.org. Chef Jerry Traumfeld is author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. He cooks at the Herb Farm restaurant outside Seattle. Now, Jerry and the restaurant have almost a cult following. People wait months for a reservation. But we are lucky enough to have him at our disposal. Jerry, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be here.
You know, Jerry, I have this ongoing search for plants that I can't kill. And one of the things I've discovered is that nasturtiums grow like weeds. Now, I know you can use the leaves in salad, but I'd like to know, what do you do with nasturtiums?
Oh, nasturtiums are so versatile. I mean, I can't imagine my garden without them because, well, not only are they beautiful, but you can eat the leaves, you can eat the flowers, you can eat the stems, the flower buds, and even the seed pods. Well, I guess, you know, one thing with the flowers is that I think people kind of, I think that nasturtiums have kind of the parsley syndrome where, you know, they're just kind of put on the side of a salad and people push them away when they eat the salad.
Mm-hmm.
I think a really important thing is that you should use them as an ingredient and dress them along with everything else. And then they actually taste delicious. They taste like watercress. And, of course, you can use the leaves. But I think a really fun thing is to use the seed pods. You can make your own capers with them.
You mean a seed pod like after the flower has bloomed?
Exactly. You know, a real caper is from a caper plant, and it's the bud, the flower bud, before it opens. But with nasturtiums, you can make capers out of the pod, which means after the bloom dies, it forms a little seed. And you have to kind of search for them on the plant. They get hidden under the leaves. And you have to make sure that you pick young ones, because once they get old, they get very hard. So they shouldn't be yellow, and you should be able to kind of nick them with your fingernail easily. To make the capers, you have to gather a jar full, which might take you a little while, and you put them in a little canning jar, and you make a brine with about 2 tablespoons of salt and a cup of water. So you bring that to a boil, pour it over the nasturtium seed pods, and just let it sit on your counter about 3 days. And then in 3 days, you drain them, and you make a vinegar. You take about a cup of white wine vinegar and a couple teaspoons of sugar, some bay leaves, and a few sprigs of thyme. You bring that to a boil. You pour it over the seed pods, and you let it sit another maybe about a week or so. And after that, you've got this little caper-like thing. It's not exactly a caper, but it tastes very similar. You can use it in exactly the same way.
Hey, this is so, I don't know, I can save a fortune on capers.
Right. A little bit of work, but it's worth it.
Okay, so we've got the capers. Now, what's the best way to keep them? Do you, in the fridge?
Oh, yeah, you just keep them in that vinegar, and you just put them in the fridge. They'll last for months and months, years maybe.
No, not in my house, they're not going.
Okay.
Hey, Jerry, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Jerry Traunfeld is author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. Now you can get his recipe for nasturtium capers on the ever-present website, splendidtable.org. This weekend marks the beginning of summer, and nothing says summer for me more than sitting on my back step with a huge wedge of watermelon and spitting those seeds. Seed spitting would seem to one a pretty innocent pastime, right? Well, not in the hands of novelist Jim Crace.
On birthdays in our village on the estuary, where spitting was as commonplace as fish, we had a sweet observance for the children. We didn't blow out candles on the cake. Instead, once we had finished feasting at the trestles under the Tarbany trees, we spat the past year out, its disappointments and its failures, the lies we'd told, our arguments, our cruelties. We expectorated all our vices, errors and misdeeds, so that our coming year could start anew. All you needed was a bunch of grapes. With the neighbours and the family gathered round, your classmates, your parents' friends, you'd have to eat one grape for every year of your life. You had to burst and eat the flesh, but save the pips. Quite difficult. To swallow one would be to swallow last year's wickedness. You tuck the pips into a corner of your mouth and push them up into the space between your top teeth and your lip. A two-year-old, and so a child relatively free from sin, would only have to store, say, 7 pips in its soft mouth. A boy of 15, a scamp, a self-abuser, and a stopper-bed, as you'd expect, would have to tuck away, say, 30 pips or more. There was, of course, a lot of laughter and some tickling to make the task more difficult. By the time you'd eaten your last grape, the birthday guests would have formed a circle and would be moving hand in hand around the birthday child. There'd be a countdown, 10, 9, 8, and on the shout of go, you'd have to spit out all your pips. You'd spray the dancing circle with your flinty, salivating sins. It was a blessing and an honour to be hit. Ours was, as I have said, a village used to spitting, and used as well to sending all its faults and all its offences into the past. It is, in fact, my 27th birthday today. I do not have the courage to phone home. I'm going out with friends tonight to celebrate, but in the hours I had to kill this afternoon, I went down to the market streets far below my small apartment to treat myself. A book, the latest Boss CD, and a bunch of local grapes, black grapes. In these supermarket days, those are the only ones with any pips. Like almost every guilty man who has neglected home and family, I am a sentimentalist. I placed the CD on the stereo, selected its romantic track. I burst my 27 homesick grapes between my teeth and stored the almost 60 pips against the soft side of my mouth. Of course, I had no dancing witnesses. I counted down from 10 to 1 myself, silently, hardly daring to move my lips. Then, standing at the open window, I threw back my head and spat my disappointments out into the street. Before I had the chance to look, I heard the clatter of my 27 birthdays strike the windscreens and the roofs of passing cars. In that same instant, I glimpsed a shaded stretch of water far beyond the town, a stand of trees, abandoned tables, and the turning circle of my half-remembered friends, smiling, smiling, but with no one at their center from whom to take the impact of those past forgiven years.
Jim Crace is author of The Devil's Larder. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia question. In honor of J.K. Rowling, the author who has gotten all those kids to read 600-page books over the summer, and of their own free will, I should add, this question is about the word muggle. What is its culinary link? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle, online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can call us at 800-537-5252. But first, here's the answer to this week's trivia challenge. In honor of J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, this question is about the word muggle. What is its culinary link? Well, it used to mean being like the tail of a fish. Now, that was way back in England in the 12th century. And fish tail stews were big things back then. I mean, think of them as great cheap eats. Of course, at that time, to be called a muggle was like being called a horse's you-know-what today. Muggle was also a word for a girlfriend, and in the 1930s, it was a street name for marijuana. All this is from the Oxford English Dictionary. They have added muggle to their list, and now it is part of the most highly regarded dictionary of the English language in the entire world. Not bad for a welfare mom-turned-writer and a kid wizard with a lightning bolt on his forehead.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. Let's see who is up. We've got Frank calling. So, Frank, what do you want to talk about? What's on your mind?
Well, Lynn, about 5 years ago, I was on a business trip in Rome, and they took us to a really nice restaurant called the Taverna Giulia, right near the Vatican, that specialized in Ligurian specialties from up around Genova, you know, the Italian Riviera. In between some of the really wonderful courses, they served a sorbetto basilico, a basil-flavored sorbet, which was just marvelous. It was a really nice intermezzo between savory courses, and it just kind of knocked us all out. And we badgered the waiter for quite a while to tell us what was in it, and he finally brought over this green bottle of liqueur di basilico, which evidently is only made in Liguria. It took me, but he wouldn't give any clues as to how you make the stuff. So finally, I found a bottle of this stuff, and I'm hoping maybe you could help me back out a sorbetto recipe now that I've got the stuff. And so, you know, it is about a 30% alcohol liqueur, so a little bit stouter than regular liqueurs.
Well, I'll tell you. I'll make a I'll do an exchange with you.
Okay.
All right? I'll give you an idea of how to do the sorbet. I want to know where you got the liqueur.
Well, some friends finally found it at a specialty shop right along the Amalfi Coast. But it is only be in those specialty shops unless you go to Liguria. If you're on the Italian Riviera,
okay,
probably easy to find.
So what you're saying is I have to shop across the ocean to get this stuff.
I certainly never found it anywhere else.
Okay, the basic way a sorbet works, all right, is you make a sugar syrup, equal parts of sugar and water, and you just simmer that until it's clear. And you chill it. Okay, so that's always step one. And then the next thing that you do is you add to it, to your taste, the main ingredient that you want in the sorbet. So, for instance, in your case, what might be a great thing to do is to actually add a ton of fresh basil. All right. And you want to add some of this liqueur. Now, the alcohol in the liqueur is going to slow down the freezing process of the sorbet, which is fine. It's going to be fine. But I think the basic idea is you make your equal parts of sugar syrup. Let's say you've got 2 cups of sugar syrup. You've done a cup of sugar and a cup of water.
Mm-hmm.
I'd throw in a cup of basil that you've, you know, maybe pureed. And once this has put it in when it's just a little warm yet, and let it sit there and infuse, along with probably, why not start with a half a cup of the liqueur? Let's go for broke here.
Okay.
And a pinch of salt, and I do the grated zest of a half a lemon in there.
because you want a little sparkle, that
sure.
no tartness. I would let that sit for about a half hour, and then I'd strain out the basil leaves. Was the sorbet actually green?
Very, very faintly, yes.
Yeah, that's okay. Okay, I would strain out the basil leaves, just put it through a fine strainer. And then, do you have an ice cream maker?
We do.
You put it in the ice cream maker and follow the directions.
All right.
All right, now start there and then start to taste. And you may want to, the next batch, you may want to try less basil, more liqueur. You know what I'm saying? Start
yep.
to play with it then. But I think that's a good place to begin.
We've got basil in the garden. I can't wait to try it.
And you know, the real key, because, you know, the whole business about the basil coming from Liguria, that's where the great pesto sauce comes from.
Sure.
And when I was there researching pesto, what was stunning to me is, do you know what the key was? They used very young basil leaves. They were from plants 6 or 8 inches tall. And I would pluck everything you can and freeze whatever you can't use right away, because it has a special flavor. It's fabulous.
All right.
Hey, enjoy.
Thanks, Lynn.
Hey, you're welcome. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us at 800-537-5252. Now, we've got Mike on the line. So, Mike, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about coffee, and I've got a two-part question for you. One is, I've been disseminating information over the years that may be wrong, and one of them runs sort of counter to what I think was in either we get you in Evansville, Indiana, on the newspaper column.
Uh-huh.
Regarding, so either on your show or in the column, how do you store coffee?
Right.
I've been telling people for many years, and I've got this from, you know, people that are in the coffee business, that you don't freeze coffee beans. And I think this ran counter to a recent either article or a radio program. And the reason I was told you don't freeze coffee beans is because what makes up the wonderful flavor of good coffees is the volatile oils, and so it's kind of like freezing a
mm-hmm.
like a can of olive
mm-hmm.
oil. But
mm-hmm.
I'm not contradicting you. I don't know. I don't know what if I'm telling people the right information. Do you, can you shed some light on that?
Well, okay, Mike. First of all, you're right. And in my advising people to freeze them, what I'm describing is the best you can do in a particular situation. Because the very, as you probably know, the very best way to experience coffee is to get it fresh roasted and to use it within several days of roasting, to buy the beans, grind them each time you make the coffee. And the big enemy, as you know, the big enemy of coffee beans and tea is light and air. You want them in a dark place, you want them completely airtight, and you don't want them to be too warm. But what all the experts say is that when the coffee is fresh roasted and still in the bean, you store it airtight in a dark place at room temperature. Now the practical side comes in, okay? You're right about the volatile oils. If you freeze it, it's going to compromise them. But the problem is, for a lot of people, and I put me in this category, I don't drink coffee every day. I always end up buying more than I really can use up quickly. So what do? You freeze the beans. Is it as good as that prime coffee? No. Is it better than having stale coffee? Yeah. So, you see, that's the experts, now there's disagreement among the experts. You know, there's some that say you freeze only in dire need. Kevin Knox, a coffee buyer, a professional roaster for Allegro Coffee, he was the one who said you use it right after it's been roasted, maximum a week, and then you get that puppy in the freezer because at least you're going to keep, you know, the beans.
Right.
But if the real ideal here is, you go to a roaster who's just roasted those beans, and you use them within a couple of days.
This is a two-part question. Can I sneak one in?
Sure, you can.
Coffee question?
Sure, you can.
And this one, there's disagreement on the experts, too, but this has been kind of a friendly bet that I used to have. It was a food answer column. I forgot where I got it. If you have an ounce or a milliliter of espresso and you have an ounce of regular coffee, which has more caffeine? I'd like to hear your answer, and it may go contrary to what I've been disseminating, and mine may be right or wrong, but I'd like to hear what you think.
Well, I make no claims here being the expert on this, but this is what I understand. If the espresso coffee has been brewed as espresso, it has less caffeine than the regular coffee. It's the very short, intense brewing time that the espresso is processed with that makes for less caffeine.
It's not the roast. It's not, you know, it's not the fact that it's a darker roast. It's the idea that the longer you brew coffee, like in a typical drip pot.
Caffeine.
Yeah. Which is why in Italy, people drink coffee all day.
Yeah, because you can.
Yeah, and they're not necessarily climbing walls.
Exactly.
Hey, well, Mike, you know, it's an ongoing process. You keep learning.
You do. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. Two great questions. You take care.
Take care. Bye.
Goodbye. Call us 800-537-5252. We'd love to talk to you. We've got Scott calling. Scott, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, we have some ducks and geese, and which happens to mean we have a steady stream of duck eggs and goose eggs.
Uh-huh.
And I like to make custards. And the problem I've been running into is with the, again, the mostly the duck eggs have been trying to do this. The yolks, I guess, are larger, and for some reason, the eggs seem to want to make little bits of scrambled egg instead of a nice smooth custard.
Nasty, stubborn little things, aren't they? Well, I think... Let me describe what would probably be the reason why you get the scrambled egg thing. And I think what it is custards are really tricky. And if you cook them either too long or they're at too high a heat, the egg scrambles. And I know that duck eggs and goose eggs are richer, but I don't necessarily think that it's the kind of egg it is as much as it's the temperature. Just briefly, can you tell me, do you bake the custards? You do it on top of the stove?
Do it on top of the stove with the constant stirring.
Constant stirring. I would do this. I'd lower the temperature down.
Okay.
And I'd use an instant reading thermometer, okay, and keep stirring. And when you get to 170 degrees, get it off the heat and put that pot, or either put it into a bowl, you know, just turn it into a bowl, okay, or just stick that pot in a big thing of ice water. It's usually just easier to turn it into a bowl because you want to stop the cooking. You don't want any residual heat because that can even continue to scramble the eggs. And what I would do is when you stir, use a flat-bottomed spatula. Because eggs are drawn to heat. The heat's like a magnet for those yolks.
Mm-hmm.
They love that heat. And you, do you end up getting a scum on the bottom of the pot?
Possibly. It's very hard to tell through all the custard.
I can understand. But the point is you want 170 degrees. That's the temperature you're going for. You want to keep moving it constantly. Better to work over lower heat than higher heat. It'll take more time.
Uh-huh.
Try that, and I'll bet you it'll solve the problem.
Oh. Well, thank you.
You take care.
Okay. Too.
Bye.
Bye.
Call us at 800-537-5252. Waiting patiently is Margie. Margie, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Double cream.
Oh, yeah. Okay. What do you want? What about double cream?
Okay. I watched British Cooks on Television.
Yeah.
And they use double cream. And I'm not sure what it is, if I can buy it here, or if we have a product that I can substitute.
Okay.
And it's in savory recipes as well as sweet.
Right. Are you watching the fabulous Nigella by any chance?
Yes, I am.
Is she not just incredible?
She's great fun.
She really is. Oh, to look like that. Okay. Double cream. You know what it is?
What is it?
The closest thing to it is our heavy whipping cream.
Oh.
It's a high-fat cream. In England, there's double cream and single cream, and single cream is a little thinner. And double cream is very rich. And that's our heavy whipping cream, which is, if I recall correctly, over 36% butterfat. But if you look for a label that says heavy whipping cream, you are going to be in business.
Thank you.
Okay. And the other, another cream tip?
Okay.
Yeah. Read the label. You want creams that don't have carrageenan in them. You don't want anything ultra pasteurized because it tastes like shaving cream. You know, if you're going to go for the cream, you look at a label and the contents on the cream package should say cream.
Okay.
And nothing else. It's going to be sweeter. It's going to have a lot more flavor.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye. Call us 800-537-5252. We came upon a website that intrigued us. It's called Jennifer's Solar Cooking Page. Jennifer Barker has written the Morning Hill Solar Cookery Book, and we decided to get her on the phone. Hey, Jennifer, thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for calling, Lynn.
Well, Jennifer, what do you mean by solar cooking? How does it work?
Well, do you remember when you were a kid, if you ever went camping with some Boy Scouts, they whipped out this reflector oven and set it up in front of the campfire?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay.
Well, solar cooking's like that, but you set your reflector oven up in front of the sun.
I mean, does this get hot enough to cook?
This gets between 350 and 450 degrees when it's empty. When you put food in, the temperature naturally falls because you've put something cold in your oven. And unlike the stove in your regular kitchen, this doesn't just crank up the heat. The sun is a pretty steady source. So it takes a while to bring the temperature back up to cooking temperature. But once it gets to cooking temperature, well, boiling is boiling, right?
Right, exactly. What kind of equipment do you use? I'm trying to picture this now.
You use a reflector oven. It has, there are several elements involved. You have a cooking vessel for the food, preferably dark to absorb sunlight as well as heat.
Right.
And often covered to keep the heat and steam in with the food.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have an outer container to hold the heat next to the cooking vessel's surface. And you have reflectors to concentrate the sun's heating power into the containers.
So could this be as simple as like aluminum foil stretched over some cardboard and a dark pot, you know, sitting in sort of a dark box? I mean, is it that easy?
Well, as a matter of fact, when my very first cooker was one I made out of cardboard boxes, aluminum foil, black paint, and a piece of glass.
I've done it.
It cost me about $5.
Well, now, what do you cook? What are the things you like to do?
Well, you know, I cook anything that I could cook in a slow cooker or in an oven. I try not to cook green vegetables in it because they like to be steamed quickly.
Uh-huh.
But I do risottos, I do cakes, gingerbreads, any yeast bread. You don't want to put too much of a load into it at once, but... I find that a peasant loaf, about a loaf and a half size, will bake just fine.
I picture you have reflectors all over the garden, and you've got the first course going here, and the bread going there, and the other stuff going over there.
Well, you're not too far off. You can make enough food in one of these to feed a family of three or four if you time everything very carefully.
Well, I think you're going to send us in some new directions. Hey, Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Jennifer Barker is author of the Morning Hill Solar Cookery book. Well, that's all there is for this week. Thanks for joining us, guys. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with these guidelines for being a guest from the Duchess of Windsor. She said, if you accept a dinner invitation, you have a moral obligation to be amusing. A mite rigid, maybe? The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. You can find everything you heard here and so much more on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. You can register for it online, again, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke, and our web mistress is Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.